today on Rocking the Suburbs.
It was Safe to Dance on the first album, The Safe to Dance. Now, the Men Without Hats are saying, no dance. Hello, everybody. It's Patrick here on behalf of Jim Lanahan. I want to welcome you to this episode of Rockin' the Suburbs. We're a music podcast that comes out every weekday, when, if, and at all possible. Starting off a new week, if you're listening to this on the day it's released, March 9th, 2026, got a couple of things to remind you of. One, want to be sending in your picks for best music you discovered in February 2026, new stuff that came out in February 2026. That's a big part of our month. We have the new music train that parades through, so we want you to send your picks in for that. If you haven't already, we already have several submissions for February 2026 new music. And I want to remind everybody to keep voting in the March Madness 90s album countdown bracket. We're having a lot of fun with that. You can go to facebook.com/suburbspod and find us over there. There's a new matchup every day until we get to the champion. We're in the second round now, so the matchups are coming thick and fast as the basketball tournaments themselves heat up for the ladies and the men on the NCAA side. We should know those picks within about a week, so you can fill out two brackets. It's going to be a lot of fun. And we will, of course, be providing periodic updates to each region. We have four regions: the sales region, the critical region, the listeners region, and the host region. And we will be providing updates, and one of those will be coming along your way this week, I believe Wednesday. With that business out of the way, I wanted to talk about something that was on my mind, and I decided to turn it into a little series of episodes for our podcast. Last week, Mark Neese had a call, a submission that we aired on an album that he really liked from the year 1975. It was Paul Simon's Still Crazy After All These Years, and I tremendously enjoyed Mark's submission, and it got me to thinking about the series that we have here on Rockin' the Suburbs. As I said, being a weekday music podcast, we have a lot of episodes. We've been doing this for a while now, so we're well into the 2000s. And in addition to that little series we did on albums of 1975, which if anybody out there would like to respond as Mark did, feel free. We'd love to have you do it. We also have a series of episodes on albums we've inducted into our own Bob Dylan Album Hall of Fame. So we've got seven or eight of those episodes out there, and there's still plenty of Dylan albums to choose from. Of course, we have our Perfect Pop series, probably our best-known series that we've done here on Rockin' the Suburbs. Anytime anybody wants to submit something into the Perfect Pop Hall of Fame, you're more than welcome to do so. We also had a series, I don't know if anybody remembers, called What Came First. Burned brightly for a little while, but it hasn't burned for a while now. And that was a series of episodes on the first record that came out on famous labels. And it's always a lot of fun to do the research on those. So all those series out there for you. And so I figured with all those series, why not add another one? I'm inaugurating this week a series on second album syndrome. Everybody, you know what this is, right? Also sometimes called the difficult second album, the sophomore slump, something like that. It's basically the challenge of how to follow up a debut album. In most cases, that's very notable, either because it's sales-wise had been a big hit, it's critically acclaimed, or, you know, something in between. It just became kind of a sensation, the debut album. And then you've got to follow it up. And I'm sure you can think of many examples of this. I'm going to talk about a few this week. Thinking a little bit about the factors surrounding the difficulty of putting out a second album, many times you think about a debut album, and bands, you know, have many months, years, in some cases, to write the and perfect these songs. And they, you know, they put out their first songs, and here it is, it's a debut album. Wow, it's a hit. And then suddenly, you know, the record company and the public are clamoring for more. Give me more of that wonderful Stone Roses sound that they got on their debut album. I want more. And oftentimes you have a very short time to go into the studio and put that record together. And hey, maybe you've already used up your best material. Who knows? Maybe you only had one album in you. The Lahs famously avoided the second album slump by never putting one out. And sometimes, you know, bands are on tour still supporting that debut album and trying to squeeze the second one in, you know, while they're doing that. And I think another factor often can be not wanting to repeat yourself. You know, if you put out an album in a certain style and you want to expand on that, or you want to do something different, or maybe the group, you know, felt like those songs were one style and now they've evolved, and that can be a challenge too. Now, on the flip side, I am going to talk this week about some great second albums that outdid a very successful debut album. And there are many cases of that too, where the band simply got stronger. They built on what they did on the debut album, and all of a sudden, you've got a new superstar act on your hands here, listening public. So I want to talk about this. I'd like to relate, to begin with, in today's episode, the first instance of me finding out and having an experience with second album syndrome. In the year 1982, I was a young lad, a young tadpole, swimming in the pond. I was a high school person. I was going to high school and very into music. I was very into classic rock. I was still a little bit in my Kiss phase, but I'd sort of left it behind by that point, and I was moving into bands like The Who and The Rolling Stones and Led Zeppelin and other things like that along the classic rock realm. I hadn't yet discovered punk rock completely. That would come in around this time. But for the most part, I was listening to guitar music. It was, you know, the basis of my foundation, my education. I was listening to classic rock radio a lot, talking with my friends, trying to find out what they were into, reading magazines. I was probably subscribing to Rolling Stone magazine at this time. And it was the next year when I purchased the Rolling Stone record guide and really started to branch out into different things. But I remember I bought an album by a group called Men Without Hats, and they had a very big single. If you remember, the song The Safety Dance was on the radio. And for me, this was like, wait a minute. There's no guitars in this music. This is a left turn for me. Like, but I like it. I really like this song. So I want to get the record and listen to this record. And I did get the album. I remember transferring it to a cassette tape so I could listen to it in my car. This was a good album. And this record came out, I believe, in early 1983 in the U.S. The Men Without Hats were a Canadian group and recorded this album early in 1982. And it came out and big hit for the Safety Dance and, you know, kind of swept over the music landscape for a few months there. And of course, it remains an iconic song, but I really like the record. There was a song on there called I Like, and that is a very good song. I Got the Message is another tune I quite dug. I liked the singer Ivan Doroshuk's voice. It's kind of like a little bit of a baritone. It was different than a lot of the singers I was used to. And again, you know, the heavy synthesizer feel of the music made me feel like, man, I'm pretty new wave now. I'm digging. This may be something for me. I really like it. I can remember also a pretty nice tune called Antarctica.
you've done.
So, yeah, I was into Men Without Hats. I thought this was a solid record. I really did. And, you know, along with all the other explorations I was doing and things I was learning about, I had really tucked my mind onto Men Without Hats. And, yeah, I thought the name was kind of goofy, but, you know, I didn't pay too much attention to it. It didn't bother me that much. Obviously, the record companies... and certainly the fans, I'm sure, and many others were very anxious to hear that follow-up record. And from what I understand, they actually the second album that came out is called "Folk of the '80s Part 3." Not one of the best song titles of all album titles of all time, but they were recording this record sometime in 1983, I believe, or they were recording stuff. And when Safety Dance became a giant hit, the band had to put these recording sessions on hold and go out on tour throughout the U.S. and to start promoting this record. So it was one of those things. I think they came back with the expectation of having a big hit. They were probably a little rushed. They put out Folk of the '80s in the spring of 1984. And boy, it's not good. It's not good at all. I was very disappointed in the fact that this thing, number one, didn't have any hits on it, had a very long song on it that was almost 9 minutes called Mother's Opinion that really was not good. I had to skip over that one pretty much every time. And Folk of the '80s, it just wasn't, you know, a concept that I could get behind. And plus, the album cover looked almost exactly like the album cover for Rhythm of Youth. It was just white, and it was almost exactly the same. It was extremely disappointing that's what it was. I just really felt let down and really felt disappointed by the second album from Men Without Hats. And here's the leadoff track, which is called No Dancing, which is kind of strange because it was safe to dance on the first album. The safe to dance. You and your friends can go out and dance. It's safe. Now, the Men Without Hats are saying, no dancing.
No dancing, no dancing, no dancing, no dancing. People try to tell me that my head is screwed on wrong, and I try to remind them that I've known it all along. I tell them that I couldn't see the writing for the wall, And summer never answers when you call. No dance.
So there you have it. I mean, maybe it doesn't sound as bad now as it did then, but yeah, it was my first experience of a second album syndrome, and it was pretty early on in my musical journey. So second album syndrome really, really stuck with me. So I'm going to talk over the next few episodes about some examples of good second albums and bad second albums. And hopefully this is a topic in which others can weigh in, because I do feel like there's a lot of cases where you can go into a record and kind of get the story of a debut and then the follow-up. And there are famous ones. There are some obscure ones. And I've got a couple examples in my mind that I want to share with you guys. So here we go, opening up the can of a new series, Second Album Syndrome, right here on Rockin' the Suburbs. So stay tuned this week, and I will toss a few more at you to get you in the mood for some second album syndrome, and then hopefully we'll get a few submissions from listeners and other people to maybe further it a little bit. But hey, there's a lot of series you can contribute to if you feel like. And I'll say this too, before we sign off for today. If you don't feel like you want to send in a voice note and record something yourself, but you feel like talking about a subject, or you feel like you have an example of this, and you wouldn't mind just jumping on a Zoom with me, I can guide everyone through it. We could talk about it together. So if it's that that's stopping you, please get in touch. You can send an email to rocketsuburbspot.com and just let me know, and be happy to jump on an episode recording with you and talk through your ideas. That would be a lot of fun. All right, folks, with that, Second Album Syndrome is inaugurated on Rockin' the Suburbs, and we'll talk to you with some more second album stuff tomorrow.
Give me more of that wonderful Stone Roses.